We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to Heritage Voices, episode 51. I'm Jessica Uquinto, and I'll be your host today. And today we are talking about language, community, and context. Before we begin, I'd like to honor and acknowledge that the lands I'm recording on today are part of the Nootch, or Ute People's Treaty Lands, the Dene'ta, and the ancestral Puebloan homeland. Today we have Dr. Jenny Davis on the show. Dr. Jenny L. Davis is a citizen of the Chickasaw Nation and an associate professor of anthropology and American Indian Studies at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, where she is the director of the American Indian Studies Program and the 2019 to 2023 Chancellor's Fellow of Indigenous Research and Ethics. After earning undergraduate degrees in the humanities from Oklahoma State University, she obtained an MA and PhD in linguistics from the University of Colorado Boulder. She was a Henry Rowe Cloud Fellow in American Indian Studies at Yale University and a Lyman T. Johnson Postdoctoral Fellow in Linguistics at the University of Kentucky. Her research focuses on contemporary Indigenous language revitalization, Indigenous gender and sexuality, and collaborative methods, ethics, and repatriation in Indigenous research. So welcome to the show, Dr. Davis.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation to join me.
Yeah, of course. I'm so excited to have you. As I was saying before we got on the air, I have a very long list of topics that I'd love to talk with you about. So I'm sure we won't get to all of it, but lots of good stuff in there, no matter what we get to. So I'm excited. So to start us off,
I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. What got you interested in this type of work?
I started out in undergrad thinking about teaching, actually, teaching language and literature and the humanities specifically. So I was focusing on English and Spanish, and I ended up getting degrees in English and Spanish. I have always loved language and literature and all of the intersections between them. And through some of my coursework in undergrad in actually English and Spanish, I was able to take some linguistics courses, learn a little bit more about the ways that linguistics and anthropology and some other fields think about language in addition to the ways fields like English, right, might think about language. Was also starting to think about my community and look around and see what was available for us and for other Native communities. So I decided to kind of move into linguistics and I moved into a professional master's on language documentation and description, and through that also a PhD. And that allowed me to start working with my tribe and with other folks who are interested in language and language revitalization, and thinking about what language means in our communities. What are the kind of historical and ongoing factors that have impacted our languages and our communities and our speakers? And so it looks like it's kind of scattered on paper, but it actually was a pretty direct line through always, you know, being interested about language and not just kind of language on paper, but the people who use and produce and find joy in language as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, was that something that you were interested in before college? Was language something that factored into your life when you were young, something that you found exciting?
Yeah, I think so. I learned Spanish growing up, in part from my mom and in part in school. And so I always loved language. I love things like poetry and the creative uses of language. I had some really phenomenal teachers in high school who were, you know, instructors of teaching English, but also teaching broader kind of humanities classes. And so I always really loved, I think, language and what it does and how people play with it and how powerful it can be. I love to read. I still am a huge nerd. I love to read and participate in the world building that happens through language and through literature. And so it was always a passion of mine. Still love that. And I still love the days when that's the kind of things that I'm getting to delve into. I would say probably there were some indicators early on that would be a thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I remember taking Spanish in high school, and I think it was kind of one of the first times where you could really see that like a different culture was more than just the obvious outside differences in a culture. When you'd ask a question and, you know, everyone would get annoyed because the teacher's like, well, they just don't say that, or that's not a, you know, like, that's just not how that works in this language. And it's like, well, what do you mean? How can it just not work? How do they not have a word for this? Yeah. So I think language is a really interesting,
It's a great way to think about differences and similarities across communities and languages. And it's a different way to think through and get exposed to things that you might not otherwise. Or I think also when we start to think about our own languages, right, there are things that we kind of suddenly pay attention to when we're thinking about the language that we might take for granted otherwise. And I love those moments.
All right. So you go to, you know, university, and then you get your master's, and then you get your PhD. And then what?
Well, my PhD, because my dissertation project was the basis for my first book, and it was working with my tribe. And so, you know, I left Oklahoma to go to grad school, for both my master's and my PhD in Colorado. But my dissertation research let me come back home. And so I got to do an internship with the tribe early on. And then later I did a year of field work where I lived with my grandfather and got to participate in those things. You know, and through that work and gaining those skills, I also kind of figured out that if it was possible, I loved the teaching aspect that I was interested in even as an undergrad. And so I pursued going into higher education in the sense of becoming a professor. So I had a postdoc, and then I became an assistant professor here at the University of Illinois 7 years ago now, I suppose. And so now I spend a lot of my time, you know, teaching and developing courses, and then also still doing my research and figuring out ways to bridge kind of the communities I work with and the ethics and the responsibilities there with the students that I teach and the things that are happening on my campus.
First, can you tell me more about your PhD project and then the book that came out of it? Your book is Talking Indian Identity and Language Revitalization in the Chickasaw Renaissance. Could you tell us more about, well, your first book, I should say. Could you tell us more about that project that led to this book?
That came out of, again, kind of working with my community and then also, you know, the things that I was observing in the training that I was getting in the courses I was taking in linguistics and anthropology in grad school. And so, you know, by the time I was in grad school in the, you know, mid-2000s, so from 2005 until 2013, and a lot of the training that I got and the conversations that I got were either thinking about languages, kind of the data of languages and examples from languages where you obviously couldn't see the communities because they were from languages all over the world. And even the discussions of language revitalization that I was seeing were focused on, you know, communities that were very different from my community. So, you know, there are really incredible examples of language revitalization if we look at Hawaii and if we look at some other communities. But I was noticing that, you know, there were things going on in my community that were different and that weren't being discussed somewhere. And so I was interested in starting to think about what are the specifics in my community and not just thinking about language itself in the sense of kind of what we were recording or writing down, but also, you know, why is this, how did we get here in the sense of, you know, Chickasaw has very few native first language speakers left. At the point when I started my research and working with the community around this topic, I think we had probably between 75 and 100. Right now, I think for when it comes to fluent speakers who started speaking as children, I think we're at 25 or so fewer. And so thinking about the specifics of our community and what was possible or not possible and how that was different from other communities. So thinking about the context and the people, thinking about the kind of hows and whys that would make what we're doing possible or even just impact the decisions that were being made that might not be visible to other people who weren't on the ground, but that also might be really helpful to people who were either an hour down the road or 1,000 miles away that, you know, had some similarity. And so thinking about the context really strongly drawing from sociolinguistics and linguistic anthropology to think about language and how and why it was working So that was kind of the focus. It led me to think about, you know, our speakers and those efforts. It led me I was interested really broadly in what was going on. So I think that the chapter that people are most interested by or in is a chapter that thinks about the role of t-shirts in language revitalization. And that's just from seeing, right? Well, that's what we wear most often, right? Jeans and t-shirts back home. And so thinking about, like, what are the roles things like bumper stickers and t-shirts play in some of these movements in our communities? And how does that help us think about language in different ways? So that's where I'm at. A lot of it was kind of responding to what I was seeing or what I was being taught and noticing the differences between the realities for natives back home and what I was reading about in kind of academic.
So with your PhD and your book, was there recommendations that came out of it that, you know, either were able to be applied or that, you know, in an ideal world would have been applied in your community? Was there any sort of like changes that happened as a result of this work?
Well, you know, I think probably it was the other direction. So one of the things is that I was kind of observing what the community was doing, what our language program was doing, and I learned a lot from them. And in fact, so there are things that people were doing on the ground that I talk about in the book, or I was able to present to other communities that have been helpful. But, you know, because these are the things that the people in the language program and that our speakers are doing kind of day in and day out, they've dedicated their lives to it. I don't know that there's anything that I taught them, but they definitely taught me the whole time. And I think offered us some opportunities. Yeah, I mean, I think there were a lot of conversations. It was a very, I don't know, easygoing kind of thing, but I definitely wasn't there to make suggestions in the sense of having more experience in this than they did. It was me kind of observing on the ground what they were doing and why, and really being mindful to ask questions about kind of what was going on and making sure that I understood and knew what I was looking at. I think that there are aspects that I've written about that, again, were already things that the community and the language program were doing, but that maybe have increased and just continued in importance through some of the conversations. So things like the thinking about the use of technology, the app, there's an Apple app, and there are all sorts of, there's now a Rosetta Stone program that the tribe kind of entirely revamped, and other scenarios where these are things that I was thinking about and asking them about. Obviously, they were the ones doing it and presenting about, and those things have continued. And so if anything, you know, if I've contributed anything, it's just kind of asking questions and participating in a conversation that continues, and that maybe through the questions that I ask, you know, shape it that way. But they're definitely the experts in how to do this in general, and especially in our community.
Yeah. So, okay, we're already going to be at a break here in a second. It always goes so fast. But after the break, I'd love to talk more about, you know, you mentioned just there that it has been, you know, what you learned from your community has been something that, you know, you've been able to take and that other communities have found useful. And I know, you know, this is one of the reasons why I was so excited to get you on this show, because, you know, we've had people asking for more on language preservation. One person in particular who works for a tribe, and they were, you know, their tribe was hoping to do more with language preservation. So you know who you are. And sorry it took me so long, but finally we're having this conversation. Yeah, so just when we get back, I'd love to hear more about, you know, what you learned from these elders that, you know, other communities have found helpful in trying to do their own language revitalization programs. So on that note, we will be back here in a moment.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code HEVO, HEVO. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's P-A-L-E-O imaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
And we are back. So I just asked you a very long question, but basically what other communities have found helpful when you've been working on language revitalization, you know, based on your experience with your PhD?
Sure. I think that some of the things that are helpful is, I mean, in some cases, just knowing that other people are doing the same thing and have the same efforts, right? So you're not alone in it. Mm-hmm. It's often, you know, working in a community, it can feel like a slightly isolated effort. But so knowing other people have been and are trying to do the same thing in itself can just be helpful. I think one of the biggest takeaways from communities is often that whatever they decide doesn't have to look like what the, you know, community down the road or the community that they've heard from looks like. So you can really tailor things to match the resources that you have and the goals and the needs of your specific community. And that's what's going to make the best program. So, there are kind of fads in language learning and language revitalization, and, you know, whether it's immersion schools or certain types of instruction, and that might be a good fit for you, but it may not. And if just because it's not the kind of whatever everybody else is doing, I think the more tailored it is and flexible the project is, the better off it's going to be. And in fact, one of my favorite things that I have both read and I think as a philosophy that's really helpful is a piece by another native linguistic anthropologist who works on language revitalization. And it's really challenging that idea of success or failure. It's a piece by Barbara Meek. And it's that, you know, you want to be kind of always adjusting and evaluating and seeing how you can approach things. But it's not the case of like that you are succeeding or failing in the sense this is a long time effort or long term effort. There are going to be things that work and things that don't work. And sometimes you can't see the results of what you're doing and the outcome for 5, 10, 15 years. And so just letting it be something that is flexible and really you can tailor it to your communities is going to be the best approach. And I think it's good in terms of having a program or efforts that really are suited to your community, and then also help counter some of the difficulties you run into in trying to think of evaluating in the sense of like, okay, have we fixed language endangerment in 3 years? Well, that doesn't happen, right? So trying to get out of that mindset. I think people speak really strongly to the importance of emotion and connection between people, between places, people and places, and the language and their memories or kind of the stories of their community. And so anything you do that celebrates that and recognizes it is going to be an important piece of it. It's going to let people approach it in a way that I think is ultimately more meaningful. And that's often a direct counter to the ways that languages may be taught in school, right? So approaching language learning as a kind of a second language approach, that doesn't always resonate with people in the ways that thinking about why they want to learn the language and learning how to tell a story that they might have heard their grandmother use, right? Or a song that they heard as kids or have always wanted to learn. So again, I think it's kind of shaking off what the models that we might have around language learning and really figuring out what works for folks and what they're hoping to get out of language. That overall is part of helping to change and counter how the language is valued. You know, the U.S. government for
centuries, and especially for very robustly over the last 100 years, has really worked to devalue Native American and Indigenous languages. It has worked to sever us from access to those languages. It has worked to shame people who spoke those languages. And so it's actually a pretty radical act just to say this language is valuable. Our language is beautiful, right? We value people who are our speakers. We value people who are learning the language or using the language. And so, again, those are more ideological shifts, but they're actually pretty radical if we think about the longer context of how we got to these moments of where our languages are now. It's a way also of, I think, including and valuing the elders and other individuals in our community who have the language and who have held on to the language. For communities that still have the language spoken in ways that bring them in and really center and value them. And I think that's an important piece of the project. And it's related to taking a kind of community and family approach. What I've noticed is that people tend to stick with the language if it's connected to either previous generations or future generations. So a lot of people are learning the language because, you know, again, it's connected to their parents or their grandparents or people that memories they had as a kid. But also people are often motivated because they want the next generation, right? Either it's their own relatives, their children, their nieces and nephews, or other family members, or people who are teachers and instructors of youth, that's often a motivation. And so thinking about the language as an important piece of community and connection can be a stronger motivator, I think, than some of the other reasons why folks might learn a language. You know, if you are being told to learn a language because it's going to help you become a rich international business person, they are probably not encouraging you to learn one of our languages. And so the motivation is going to be different. I don't know that learning our languages, it can be a career, right? It can be a job for folks, but I don't know that it makes anyone a millionaire. So the motivation is different, and that we need to recognize that, but it opens up a lot of other approaches. And I mentioned, you know, thinking about other ways of structuring language and learning and language use. So I know communities that have involved multiple generations. So they have maybe a family that includes 2 to 3 generations learning together, that's often a really robust way that people have reported back saying, you know, I really did learn a lot out of it. And it means that they aren't learning the language in a class and then going home and not using the language. So it allows that kind of continuity to happen. And then one of the things I think that was just an interesting thing that came out of the fact that the research that went into my book spanned across, more than 10 years, is noticing the kind of long-term impacts of things that I think we wouldn't necessarily think of as having major impact. So things that were kind of passive language use, so like signs that people had up in their buildings or around town that over, you know, you see it once or twice, it's around, you don't think that much of it. But over time, it actually transformed people's experiences so that, you know, after a while, people had been seeing the language and reading the language now for 5-10 years, and kind of everybody had seen the language, whereas before almost no one had, right? It wasn't available to people, and it was happening in a really passive way. They weren't going somewhere to read something in the language. They just happened to be at our tribal hospital, or they just happened to go to like the rec center or see it on somebody's t-shirt. And so those kinds of passive language absorption and language learning are pretty impactful over the long run, and they just kind of shift what people's experiences with the language are. And I'm often struck by the fact that one of the, you know, contexts that I looked at was the Chickasaw Nation has a kids language club, which is really popular, and it has little ones, I think, gosh, I don't know how young they are, at 5 or maybe a little younger, all the way up to kind of teens. And they're learning the language, doing fun activities on the weekends. But one of the things that happened over that kind of 10-year span was that little ones that were 5 when I started thinking about this and doing research are now 15, right? And so then it was an ability to see that there's a generation, a new generation that has actually grown up with these kind of language programs in place and have grown up kind of always seeing the language around and reading it and interacting with it in that way. And that's a radical change from my generation and definitely generations older than me. So the impact is sometimes probably kind of frustratingly might take longer or come in places where you aren't expecting it to, but that it may be just as impactful as thinking about setting up, you know, a class that people are meeting in and everybody dedicating their time. And so I think that's one of the things that has been had one of the more surprising impacts, I think, are those kind of slow burn kind of results and slow change that you don't see until 5, 10, 15 years later.
Are there any projects that you've worked on since then that you've been like particularly excited about or would want to share with this audience, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it just depends on the types of projects. So one of the things that I am very excited to get to do is I teach every other summer at what's called the Collaborative Language Institute. And it started when I was a grad student. And the goal is to train academics, if they're interested in this type of work, but especially community members in how to do the language documentation and revitalization and, you know, language policy and change ourselves. And it's a really cool project. It's an international program. So we get folks from throughout the US, we get folks from Canada, and then we also get people really from kind of around the world. And I often teach a course on language activism. I co-teach it with a member of the Kisi or Gusii community, Kennedy Bosire. It's a really cool opportunity to see these kinds of skill sets and this type of work that often, you know, you had to go somewhere else. Like if you're me, you have to go to another state and pay a lot of money to learn those skill sets and instead see them operating in a way and being offered in a way that's accessible to community members and accessible to people to then bring back to our communities, right? To not have to leave the community to be able to also have conversations across lots of different contexts in order to understand what's possible and how you might want to approach things. So that's, in terms of projects, it's one that I really love. And there are similar programs in Canada and I think increasingly different parts of the world. But I think that's something that I'm always really excited about. Like, how do I take things that I gained through a formal education process and redistribute them and think about, right, like who has access to things? I've gotten to do some work to a current project I'm working on is one that is trying to get information about all of the language revitalization programs in the country for now and put all of that information together in one place and to actually put it, visualize it in a map so that, you know, when we're interested in who else is doing this work, where are they doing this work? Is there a community whose language is related to mine that, you know, and what are they doing? So really trying to take this information that's not available, that's often hard to get and hard to locate and pull it all together in one place to create some resources and connect everybody who's doing this work so that we aren't reinventing the wheel every time, so that communities aren't, well, one, feeling isolated, it is a thing that comes up quite often, and that the, you know, if communities have resources or they have gone through processes, that kind of information is available to anyone else who's doing this. It happens. I think the model that I think of is because back home in Oklahoma, we have so many tribes and there's often a lot of conversation and cooperation across Native communities in ways that I think are really helpful. You can call up, you know, a community next door or one a couple hours away and say, oh, I know you guys have had a, you know, a preschool immersion program. What did that look like? Or, hey, we need to have some flashcards, but, you know, we don't have enough money to put into it. Can we have the art that you used? Right. So lots of kind of collaborative approaches. So the mapping project we're doing right now is really the goal is to really highlight and recognize all of these community-led initiatives to shift the narrative that says that these are efforts that are coming out of academic spaces when really they're coming out of communities who have been and are doing this work in really profound ways. And that also, like, house kind of that information all together so that people don't have to spend their time that they would be spending teaching language or doing language documentation or whatever they want to be doing in their communities, searching for it, right? To do a little bit of that legwork for folks. So those are my two projects, I suppose, I'd highlight for now.
Yeah, that's amazing. Because that's also nice, because that's resources for people that they can take what you're talking about and apply it. My next question, I think I want to ask about like the way people talk about language and language revitalization, the way people talk about it. Is there ways that you would like it to be reframed, or if there's things that when people talk about language revitalization that you wish that they would think about it in a slightly different way?
So there are a couple of different things that come to mind. One is that I think, you know, it's something that I hinted at in the last question towards the end. There's a tendency within kind of media or academic circles to credit and really center and highlight the kind of the white linguist or the outside person who came in and saved a language or, you know, convinced a community to do whatever. And I think that's a really tired narrative, and it's never really representing what's going on. And so in terms of how people are talking about language revitalization, being mindful of kind of who's doing the work and where it's coming from, and centering the communities themselves. There are a number of discussions that come out of communities themselves when we think about different communities and what it means. One of them is that people often use terms like language death or extinction. And that actually is a really, it's coming out of like a biological, ecological framework, but it's not a great one for communities or languages in general, for various reasons. I don't know how well it works. I mean, you know, it's complicated even in ecological terms, but, you know, there are communities that have been declared dead, where their languages are dead or extinct, that in fact have been able to revitalize them. And so that have been able to raise new speakers and, you know, create robust language programs and language communities. And so the better framing that people have a couple of different ideas, but one of them that I think is the standard now is to think about languages as dormant and that can reawaken, that allows for a possibility for these things to be reclaimed, that allows people to connect with language and not have it be undead, not have it be zombie-ish, right? So I'm thinking of Wesley Leonard, who's a Miami scholar, has done a lot of work on this, and because Miami is a language that was dormant and is now spoken again. So of course this is quite personal to have someone tell you your language is dead, right? I think thinking about the language we use is important. I am quite passionate about the ways that people are framing always assuming an end to native people and to culture. So there's a scholar, Jeannie O'Brien, who's done great work thinking about the framing of last Indians and the fact that, you know, the last of the Mohicans and the last of the, it's always the last, right? And people are kind of always counting down and assuming we're going to disappear and die. And they have been, what her work shows so well is they have been since the 1600s, 1700s, right? This is a thing that happened. And that's why it's part of why non-Native people always seem to be a little surprised to find out we're still alive. Right. They're like, oh, they're still Indians. Oh, you know. And so those kinds of narratives. And what I found is that that narrative extends to thinking about languages. So there's a lot of media coverage about last speakers and counting down how many speakers are left in ways that I think, one, never talk about why we're in this situation, right? This is never a conversation about right. Boarding schools. It's never a conversation about, you know, not recognition tribal sovereignty. And it's also, you know, it counts down in ways that assume there wouldn't be people who are partial speakers or multilingual or the really complicated and exciting ways that language actually works in our communities. So that anytime it's a kind of counting down or talking about natives or our cultures as, you know, disappearing any second, I think is something to be wary of and mindful about the work it does. It's one thing when we have conversations in our own communities about, you know, the situation or what we need to prioritize and why. And I think that's another thing when you have a kind of a broad media coming out of the settler colonial context where they're having those conversations, right? Like I think, so those are yeah. some of the ones that come to mind kind of automatically thinking about why is this thing circulating and what kind of story is it telling about it? And I guess, you know, that discussion about the last speaker's part, one of the things that's so notable to me is that language revitalization programs have been going on in various Native and Indigenous communities for decades now, right? Sometimes 50 years if we're looking at Hawaii. And yet there isn't the same interest in storytelling about that. There's not the same stories about the new speakers and the languages that have, and communities, right, that are really shifting what that situation looks like. And so I think there's a preference for a particular story about natives and about natives through our languages that we don't see the reverse and inverse of.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that note, we are already at our second break.
All right.
So we will be right back.
Hello, it's Jim Eagle. Please join us for the Bay Area American Indian Two-Spirit Society's 11th annual Two-Spirit Powwow in person or online this year at San Francisco Fort Mason Center on Saturday, February 12th, 2022. Gore dance at noon and grand entry begins at 1 p.m. There will be over 60 vendors selling all types of indigenous products and crafts. Powwow dancers from all over the U.S. will be competing in contests all day long. We'll also be having several delicious fry bread taco vendors. For more information, go to baits.org. That's BAAITS.org. COVID protocols will be in effect. See you there.
Okay, we are back from our break, and you know, we've been talking a lot about language revitalization, but a lot of your work ties into language and other topics. During the segment, I want to make sure we get to language and gender and sexuality and, you know, NAGPRA and your ethics works. But let's start with the book.
Okay.
So your second book is called Queer Excursions, Retheorizing Binaries in Language, Gender, and Sexuality. So I'm really interested, you know, again, we've talked over the two segments about language revitalization, but I'm curious to hear how you apply linguistic anthropology to these other topics. So can you tell our guests more about the second book?
Sure. So that book, it's an edited volume that I co-edited with colleagues from grad school, Lal Zimmern and Joshua Racklaw. And it is thinking about, I think, assumptions of binaries and how do we approach language and studying them that way, particularly binaries of gender and sexuality, right? So we have things like male or female or heterosexual or homosexual or cisgender or trans, lots of things that are set up as kind of two oppositional, non-overlapping categories and only two categories. And so that book came out in 2014 and was really each chapter in it is thinking about that from a different approach, thinking about in a different context. So there are chapters from various communities and contexts around the world and really, I guess, challenging us to not just throw binaries out, right? There are reasons why for communities in different moments they might be valuable or important, but also to recognize that they are often kind of ideological or theoretical constructs, right, that are happening. Sometimes they're grammatical, any number of things. So it's really thinking about them in that approach and how we can approach studying gender and sexuality and keeping them in mind and not kind of blindly either reinforcing them or throwing them away. And my chapter in that is part of a longer standing project that I have thinking about language, gender, and sexuality, particularly in Native American and Indigenous context in the U.S. That stems and is connected to my research with Two-Spirit activism and Two-Spirit communities. For any listeners who aren't familiar, Two-Spirit is it's a complicated term, and teasing it apart could be its own, well, mini podcasts. So more than anything, Two-Spirit it's kind of an umbrella term in the sense that it's obviously an English term that's used to refer and recognize that there are a lot of identities and practices within Native communities that don't fit neatly into the idea coming out of white Western European and Christian models that say that gender is binary, it's only male or female, and it's based on a notion of biological sex, or the assumption that everybody is heterosexual, or various things like that. So it's often the Two-Spirit community is often kind of quickly and identified as kind of LGBTQ natives. That doesn't get to nearly the most interesting or complex parts of it. But one of the pieces of that is thinking about like where language plays into it and why, if you are studying language revitalization or linguistics and language, gender, and sexuality, that language revitalization is often assumed to be a totally separate topic of research or interest, language, gender, and sexuality. And that was a really interesting component for me as a Two-Spirit and queer Native woman because I was at these Two-Spirit gatherings and events and seeing Indigenous languages used all the time and thinking, you know, why is it that these are presumed to be separate topics and things that you wouldn't discuss together and wouldn't be relevant to, you know, discussions of language revitalization. And that's also helped me really start to think about, like, why are we not talking more robustly about things like kinship and gender and relationality in some of the language revitalization conversations? How do we make sure that language revitalization is inclusive to all of our community members and that's not reinforcing these kind of colonial ideas or causing people to, you know, not be a part of our communities in general and in language efforts more specifically? And of course, one of the coolest things about, well, there are so many cool things about it, our languages, but there are words in our languages and ways of expressing and describing people that are far beyond those binaries that we keep seeing reproduced, right? So you have in languages like Chickasaw that doesn't have a grammatical gender. And so you don't have pronouns that are for he, she, right? You don't have things like in Spanish or French where each noun would be marked for being masculine or feminine, or in some languages, neuter. And so really taking a moment to think about too, how our languages can guide us through that process of reconnecting and really cherishing the ways our communities approached gender and sexuality and kinship, relationality to each other and to ourselves as a thing to study. So that's how I tend to think about that. The cool thing about Two-Spirit gatherings and thinking about it through the lens of that community and that realm of activism is that it's a inherently multi-tribal, not pan-tribal, there's an important distinction, right? Multi-tribal space. So what we see are how Indigenous languages, how do people use Indigenous languages in a multi-tribal space? And what I've seen is very parallel to like a powwow society, or if you're on a campus, the Native student organizations, or even like an urban Indian center, where you have norms of language use that are also probably pretty similar to contexts where you'd have lots of tribes in a small area, right? Where people learn how to say hello and thank you and those types of words in other people's languages. And that language use is not a claiming that identity for yourself, right? If I say thank you to somebody back home or hello in, say, Cherokee, I'm not claiming to be Cherokee through using the language. I'm in fact acknowledging that they are Cherokee by using it. And so I think it's a great way too for us to think about a context that has been under-discussed or not discussed in a field like linguistic anthropology as it relates, because of it relates to gender and sexuality, but use it as a lens to turn back and say, okay, what else are we not seeing? And that includes multi-tribal spaces. It includes how are Indigenous languages being used and revitalized in urban contexts, right? Because that doesn't look exactly the same as rural Oklahoma. And so I love to see where all of the things are actually threaded together, even though they've often been assumed to be separate. Early on, it seemed like they were two wildly separate projects. But the longer I sit with it and think about it and think with other people about them, the more I see that they're like really strongly woven together. And that's a pretty exciting area for me to continue to see those kinds of connections.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this very obviously very easily could have been its own podcast episode. And I know that there's a couple of you listening who are going to be very sad at me right now because you know who you are, and I want to make sure we get to some other stuff. But yeah, if you're interested in learning more about these topics, obviously Dr. Davis has you know, articles and this book and different resources. And then also check out the museum representation and intersectionality episode of Heritage Voices. That's episode 24, which also talks about some of these same issues. So sorry, guys. Obviously, I could really keep talking about this for a lot longer, but I do want to make sure we get to talking about your work that looks at both language, NAGPRA, repatriation, those topics. So yeah, so let's move on to that area of your work now.
So yeah, currently I am pretty heavily involved in the NAGPRA work at my university. And in some ways it's new, and in some ways it's connected to things that I had been interested in before. So I am at a university, and like a lot of universities, we have some room to work. There's a lot of work that needs to happen around ensuring that any of the ancestors that are on my campus or other types of objects and collections that need to go home to communities are going home to communities, and that no matter what, we're working collaboratively with tribes. So I started working on that effort on my campus in 2017. And so we now have on campus a campus-wide NAGPRA office, and we have a full-time NAGPRA officer who's doing really fantastic work. And so it's really, that happened in January of last year. So we're working on getting those efforts off the ground. We're working on figuring out as a campus, not just how do we comply with this law and the specifics of the law, but how do we really rework how we're doing things on campus so that research that involves Native people and Indigenous people is done collaboratively with those communities, right, and with those individuals. And so that's it takes up quite a bit of my time currently, and it's obviously it's important work. It's work that just came about because I was on a campus and it needed to happen, right? And it's not the kind of work that I think you can walk away from in good conscience. So it's a thing I've taken up. It's required training in NAGPRA and other types of things. But it's also been a way of thinking about the kinds of areas where I was already interested in these topics, or the places where, you know, Indigenous and collaborative approaches that I got through thinking about how to do this with language are relevant to any other type of process with Indigenous research, and especially with things like NAGPRA and repatriation. Early on, it was clear, both for my community and others, that there are lots of language material. I would assume that even as much as 75% or more of the kind of linguistic and cultural documentation materials, some of it's as old as 200 years ago, and some of it was collected 5 years ago, right, is not available to our communities. And so they sit on the, it sits on the shelves of, you know, professors' offices or in libraries or in archives, and our communities don't know where it is, and they don't have access to it. And sometimes even if they know where it is, they're not allowed to access it. And so that was already something I was interested in. How do we find out where these things are? How do we make it so that the communities themselves have access to it? And so they have it. It plays an important role in language revitalization, but it's also just a kind of inherently ethical and right thing to do, to let the communities and the families and the people from whom these important pieces of community have been taken from, right, to get them back and to allow people to have access. And so that transfers really directly to those processes of repatriation. Under NAGPRA, thinking about museum collections or archaeological collections, right? How do we make sure people know where things are located and that they're being housed and treated respectfully and that they get back and that nothing's being done with them that the communities haven't agreed to? And so that's connected. I think my background in language and linguistic anthropology also helps me really keep in mind that the idea that something like the documentation of a song or a story is inherently different than an object or even an ancestor that's being housed. You know, if it's our songs, our stories, our languages, those are really important to us. And we often have, in many communities, that we have a kind of an obligation or an expectation to care for them. You know, they were taken under the same circumstances, often through the same methods and by the same people. An individual that's considered one of the founders of linguistic anthropology, and in fact, in North America, Boas, was responsible for taking Native American remains while he was collecting language and cultural documentation. He collected them without permission from communities and then used the selling of those remains to fund his research. And so I think kind of breaking down the assumption that linguistic and cultural materials are inherently different than something like a museum or archaeological collection or ancestors, often as a reason not to repatriate them or not to, because they don't fall under NAGPRA, is a way to apply and a place to make an intervention from indigenous ways of doing things rather than a kind of Western institutional approach or U.S. institutional approach. So thinking about what the connections are and like what would an alternative strategy be that actually assumes that anything that's come from a community should be, you know, you should work in collaboration with communities to repatriate and to allow access to. And these are exciting areas that I think happen sometimes in subfields or particular institutions, but they're not always brought together in conversation. And so the fact that I am doing the NAGPRA work now allows me to sit back and think about it in a slightly broader context. Because, of course, in our communities, they're all connected in the sense that the responsibilities to objects, to beings, to ancestors are connected to language practices. They are connected to spiritual and ceremonial practices. And a lot of times those, that linguistic and cultural documentation was of our ceremonies, right? And of our important, the pieces of cultural patrimony in our communities. So they are connected. It's taken a slightly different approach, I guess, because of the importance of reconciling, recognizing and really prioritizing, making sure our ancestors get home. And so it's not to say that linguistic materials are less important, but there can be some, if it's necessary to prioritize, to really think about those distinctions and make sure that we're trying to do everything as broadly and holistically as possible while still prioritizing, you know, the things that are of utmost urgency to our communities, like getting ancestors home.
Yeah, I hadn't quite thought about it in exactly that way before. So that's really interesting. We have just a few minutes left. So I just wanted to see if there was anything that you still feel like you'd like to share with our audience, anything that you didn't get to yet.
You know, but before we started recording, one of the things we were talking about was the variety of approaches and topics and projects, I guess, that I've worked on, but I think is pretty typical of Native people in academic spaces and maybe even other underrepresented faculty and staff and students. And I suppose in just thinking about all of the topics that we've talked about, that in many ways kind of represents a different approach to academic work and maybe to research in general, to assume connections, and that, you know, each project may look separate or be different, but then as you work in it and as you have conversations, you can see the connections between them. And so that keeping things easily delineated between academic discipline or topic is actually a pretty generative and exciting approach to things. At least from my perspective, and maybe as if there are people who are considering what to study or how to approach the things that they're interested in, that can be a way to hold all of the things that are important to them rather than having to feel like they have to choose between them.
Right. Well, and even between, you know, your academic work and your creative work, you know, like that there's a lot to play with there as well.
Yeah, I think anything that allows us to be our whole selves and to bring all of the things that we experience and are interested in is only going to make each aspect of our work and our life better. And so in part, it may involve resisting that insistence from whatever corners that it comes from, right? That you make choices, or that you only do one thing, or that you have to choose between research and community or academic work and creative work. That isn't necessarily the case. So to hold on to anything that allows you to keep all of those things at play and as part of your life.
Love it. Well, all right. Thank you so much for coming on today. I personally really learned a huge amount, and I hope that everyone listening did as well.
Well, thanks again for the opportunity to have this chat and conversation. It's been great talking with you.
Thanks for listening to the Heritage Voices podcast. You can find show notes at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/Heritage Voices. Please subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or the Google Music Store. Also, if you like the show, please share with your friends or write us a review. If you have any questions, comments, or show suggestions, please reach out to me at jessica@livingheritageanthropology.org, or you can find me on Facebook through Living Heritage Anthropology or on Twitter @LivingHeritageA. As always, thank you to Lyle Blanqua and Jason Nez for their collaboration on our incredible logo.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.